which is fluorescent green, like antifreeze. "I'm scared," he says.
"I know," says the nurse.
"I want you all to go to hell."
"That's natural."
One team leaves, another comes in. They take an intense interest in his chest. An hour 45.
"I'm afraid we need to stop talking now."
"No, go away."
"I'll be here, but we won't be able to talk anymore."
The fear surrounds him, threatening to take him under. He tries to replace it with anger, but the fear is too strong. He tries to replace it with the satisfaction that Connor will be taken very soon, but not even that makes him feel better.
"You'll feel a tingling in your chest," says a surgeon. "It's nothing to worry about."
2 hours, 5 minutes.
"Blink twice if you can hear me."
Blink, blink.
"You're being very brave."
He tries to think of other things, other places, but his mind keeps being drawn back to this place. Everyone's so close around him now. Yellow figures lean all around him like flower petals closing in. Another section of the table is taken away. The petals move in closer. He does not deserve this. He has done many things, not all good, but he does not deserve this. And he never did get his priest. 2 hours, 20 minutes.
"You'll feel a tingling in your jaw. It's nothing to worry about." "Blink twice if you can hear me."
Blink, blink.
"Good."
He locks his eyes on the nurse, whose eyes still smile. They always smile. Someone made her have eternally smiling eyes.
"I'm afraid you're going to have to stop blinking now."
"Where's the clock?" says one of the surgeons. 2 hours, 33 minutes. "We're running late." Not quite darkness, just an absence of light. He hears everything around him, but can no longer communicate. Another team has entered.
"I'm still here,"
the nurse tells him, but then she falls silent. A few moments later, he hears footsteps, and he knows she's left.
"You'll feel a tingling in your scalp," says a surgeon. "It's nothing to worry about."
It's the last time they talk to him. After that, the doctors talk like Roland is no longer there. "Did you see yesterday's game? Heartbreaker. Splitting the corpus callosum."
"Nice technique."
"Well, it's not brain surgery." Laughter all around. Memories tweak and spark. Faces. Dreamlike pulses of light deep in his mind. Feelings. Things he hasn't thought about in years. The memories bloom, then they're gone. When Roland was 10, he broke his arm. The doctor told his mom he could have a new arm or a cast. The cast was cheaper. He drew a shark on it. When the cast came off, he got a tattoo to make the shark permanent. "If they had just made that three-pointer, it'll be the Bulls again or the Lakers." Starting on the left cerebral cortex, another memory tweaks.
"When I was 6, my father went to jail for something he did before I got born. I never knew what he did, but Mom says I'm just the same."
"The Suns don't stand a chance. Well, if they had a decent coaching staff." Left temporal lobe.
"When I was 3, I had a babysitter. She was beautiful. She shook my sister real hard. My sister got wrong. Never got right again. Beautiful is dangerous. Better get them first."
"Well, maybe they'll make the playoffs next year. Or the year after that. Did we get the auditory nerves?" "Not yet. Getting them right now."
I'm alone. And I'm crying. And no one's coming to the crib. And the nightlight burned out. And I'm mad. I'm so mad.
Left frontal lobe.
I don't feel so good.
Left occipital lobe.
I don't remember where.
Left parietal lobe.
I I can't remember my name, but...
Right temporal.
But I'm still here.
Right frontal.
I'm still here.
Right occipital.
I'm still...
Right parietal.
I'm...
Cerebellum.
I'm...
Thalamus.
Hi.
Hypothalamus.
Hi.
Hippocampus. Medulla. Where's the clock? 3 hours, 19 minutes. All right, I'm on break. Prep for the next one. 62. Lev. The detonators are hidden in a sock in the back of his cubby. Anyone who finds them will think they're band-aids. He tries not to think about it. It's Blaine's job to think about it, and to tell him when it's time. Today, Lev's unit of tithes are taking a nature walk to commune with creation. The pastor who leads them is one of the more self-important ones. He speaks as if every word out of his mouth were a pearl of wisdom, pausing after each thought as if he expects someone to write it down. He leads them to an odd winter bear tree. Lev, who is used to winters with ice and snow, finds it odd that trees in Arizona still lose their leaves. This tree has a multitude of branches that don't quite match, each with different bark and a different texture. I wanted you to see this, the pastor says to the crew. It's not much to see now, but, oh, you should see it in the spring. Over the years, many of us have grafted branches from our favorite trees to the trunk. He points to the various limbs. This branch sprouts pink cherry blossoms, and this one fills with huge sycamore leaves. This one fills with purple jacaranda flowers, and this one grows heavy with peaches. The tithes examine it, touching its branches cautiously, as if it might at any moment turn into the burning bush. What kind of tree was it to begin with? Asks one of the tithes. The pastor can't answer him. I'm not sure, but it really doesn't matter. What matters is what it's become. We call it our little tree of life. Isn't it wonderful? There's nothing wonderful about it. The words are out of Lev's mouth before he realizes he's spoken them, like a sudden, unexpected belch. All eyes turn toward him. He quickly covers. It's the work of man, and we shouldn't be prideful, he says. When pride comes, then comes disgrace. But with humility comes wisdom. Yes, says the pastor. Proverbs 11, isn't it? Proverbs 11:2. Very good. He appears suitably humbled. Well, it is pretty in the spring. Their path back to the tithing house takes them by fields and courts where the terribles are being observed and brought to the best possible physical condition before their unwinding. The tithes endure the occasional jeers and hisses from the terribles like martyrs. It's as they pass one of the dormitories that Lev finds himself face to face with someone he never expected to see again. He finds himself standing in front of Connor. Each was heading in a different direction. Each sees the other at the same instant and stops short, staring in absolute shock. Lev? Suddenly the pompous pastor is there, grabbing Lev by both shoulders. Get away from him, the pastor snarls at Connor. Haven't you done enough damage already? Then he spirits Lev away, leaving Connor standing there. It's all right, says the pastor, his protective grip on Lev's shoulders still firm as they stride away. We're all aware of who he is and what he did to you. We were hoping you wouldn't find out he was at the same harvest camp, but I promise you, Lev, he will never harm you again. And then he says quietly, he's being unwound this afternoon. What? And good riddance, too. It's not unusual to see tithes unsupervised on the grounds of Happy Jack, although they're usually in clusters, or at the very least, groups of two. It's rare to see one hurrying alone, almost running across the fields. Lev hadn't lingered long once he got back to the tithing house. He took the first opportunity to slip out. Now he searches everywhere for Blaine and Mai. Connor is being unwound this afternoon. How could this have happened? How did he get here? Connor was safe at the graveyard. Did the Admiral throw him out, or did he leave on his own? Either way, Connor must have been caught and brought here. The one thing Lev had taken comfort in, the safety of his friends, has now been torn away. Connor's unwinding must not be allowed, and it's in Lev's power to stop it. He finds Blaine in the grassy commons between the dining hall and the dormitories, being put through a regimen of calisthenics with his unit. Blaine does them oddly, putting as little force into them as possible, making all his moves low impact.
I need to talk to you.
Blaine looks at him, surprised and furious.
What, are you crazy? What are you doing here?
A staffer sees him and makes a beeline toward them. After all, everyone knows tithes and terribles do not mix.
It's all right, Lev tells the staffer. I know him from home. I just wanted to say goodbye.
The staffer reluctantly nods his approval. All right, but make it quick. Lev pulls Blaine aside, making sure they're far enough away that nobody can hear.
We're doing it today, Lev tells him. No more waiting.
Hey, says Blaine, I decide when we do it, and I say not yet.
The longer we wait, the longer we risk going off by accident.
So, randomness works too. He wants to hit Blaine, but knows if he does, they'll probably leave a crater in the field 50 yards wide. So he tells Blaine the only thing he knows for sure will get him to give in.
They know about us, whispers Lev.
What?
They don't know who it is, but they know there are clappers here. I'm sure they're reviewing the blood test right now, looking for anything unusual. It won't be long until they find us.
Blaine grits his teeth and curses. He thinks for a moment, then starts shaking his head.
No, I'm not ready. It doesn't matter if you're ready. You want chaos? Well, it's coming today whether you want it or not. Because if they find us, what do you think they'll do?
Blaine looks even sicker at the prospect. They'll detonate us in the forest?
Or out in the desert where no one will ever know?
Blaine considers it for a moment more, then takes a deep, shuddering breath.
I'll find Mai at lunch and tell her. We'll go at 2 o'clock sharp. Make it 1.
Lev rummages through his cubby, getting more and more frantic.
Those socks have to be here. They have to be. But he can't find them.
The detonators aren't crucial, but they're cleaner. Lev wants it to be clean. Clean and quick.
That's mine.
Lev turns to see the tow-headed kid with the emerald green eyes standing behind him.
That's my cubby. Yours is over there.
Lev looks around and realizes he's off by one bed. There's nothing in the unit to identify one bed or one cubby from another.
If you need socks, I can lend you. No, I've got enough of my own, thanks.
He takes a deep breath, closes his eyes to get his panic under control, and goes to the right cubby. The sock with the detonators is there. He slips it into his pocket.
You okay, Lev? You look kind of funny.
I'm fine. I've just been running, that's all. Running on the treadmill.
No, you haven't, says the kid. I was just in the gym.
Listen, mind your own business, okay? I'm not your buddy. I'm not your friend.
But we ought to be friends.
No, you don't know me. I'm not like you, okay, so just leave me alone.
Then he hears a deeper voice behind him.
That's enough, Lev.
He turns to see a man in a suit. It's not one of the pastors, but the counselor who admitted him a week ago.
This can't be good.
The counselor nods to the tow-headed kid.
Thank you, Sterling.
The boy casts his eyes down and hurries out.
We assign Sterling to keep an eye on you and make sure you're adjusting. We are, to say the least, concerned.
Lev sits in a room with the counselor and two pastors,
The sock bulges in his pocket. He bounces his knees nervously, then remembers he's not supposed to make any jarring motions, or he might detonate. He forces himself to stop.
"You seem troubled, Lev," says the counselor. "We'd like to understand why."
Lev looks at the clock. It's 12:48. 12 minutes until he, Mai, and Blaine are supposed to meet and take care of business.
"Being tithed," Lev says. "Isn't that enough of a reason?"
The younger of the two pastors leans forward.
"We try to make sure every tithe enters the divided state in the proper frame of mind."
"We wouldn't be doing our job if we didn't try to make things right for you," says the elder pastor,
then offers a smile so forced it's more like a grimace. Lev wants to scream at them, but he knows that won't get him out of here any faster.
"I just don't like being around other kids right now. I'd rather prepare for this alone, okay?"
"But it's not okay," says the older pastor. "That's not the way we do things here. Everyone supports one another."
The junior pastor leans forward.
"You need to give the other boys a chance. They're all good kids."
"Well, maybe I'm not." Lev can't help but look at the clock again. 12:50. Mai and Blaine will be in place in 10 minutes. And what if he's still here in this stinking office? Won't that be just great?
"Have somewhere you need to be?" the counselor asks. "You keep checking the time."
Lev knows his answer needs to make sense, or they truly will become suspicious of him.
I heard the kid who kidnapped me was being unwound today. I was just wondering if it had happened yet."
The pastors look at one another and at the counselor, who leans back in his chair as calm as can be.
"If he hasn't been, he will be shortly.
Lev, I think it would be healthy for you to discuss what happened to you while you were held hostage."
"I'm sure it was horrible.
But talking about it can take away the power of the memory. I'd like to hold a special group tonight with your unit. It'll be a time for you to share with the others what you've been holding inside. I think you'll find they'll be very understanding."
"Tonight," Lev says.
"Okay, fine. I'll talk about everything tonight.
Maybe you're right and it'll make me feel better."
"We just want to ease your mind," says one of the pastors.
"So can I go now?"
The counselor studies him for a moment more.
"You seem so tense. I'd like to talk you through some guided relaxation exercises."
63. Guard. He hates his job. He hates the heat. He hates that he has to stand in front of the chop shop for hours guarding the doors, making sure no one unauthorized enters or leaves. He had dreams back in Steho of starting a business with his buddies. But no one loans startup money to Steho kids. Even after he changed his last name from Ward to Mullard, the name of the richest family in town, he couldn't fool anyone. Turns out half the kids from his state home took on that name when they left, figuring they could outsmart the world. In the end, he outsmarted no one but himself. The best he could do was find a series of unfulfilling jobs in the year he's been out of Steho, the most recent of which is being a harvest camp guard. On the roof, the band has started its afternoon set. At least that helps the time to pass a little more quickly. Two unwinds approach and climb the steps toward him. They're not being escorted by guards, and both carry plates covered with aluminum foil. The guard doesn't like the look of them. The boy's a fleshhead. The girl is Asian.
"What do you want? You're not supposed to be here."
"We were told to give this to the band."
They both look nervous and shifty. This is nothing new. All unwinds get nervous near the chop shop, and to the guard, all unwinds look shifty. The guard peeks under the aluminum foil. Roast chicken, mashed potatoes. They do send food up to the band once in a while, but usually it's staff that carries the food, not unwinds. "I thought they just had lunch."
"Guess not," says the fleshhead.
He looks like he'd rather be anywhere in the world but standing in front of the chop shop, so the guard decides to draw it out, making them stand there even longer.
"I'll have to call this in," he says.
He pulls out his phone and calls the front office. He gets a busy signal. Typical. The guard wonders which he'd get in more trouble for, letting them bring the food in.